This episode of Hot Breath is sponsored by our Patreon. If any of our content has helped your comedy career, join our Patreon linked in the show notes and get positive comedy karma for life. Probably.
Also, Louis did a weird thing, and I don't know if I should be divulging all this, but we would be sitting there, and like they're like, all right, we got to change the lens. So now we're all sitting at this bar, just kind of like, okay, well, they're changing a lens. It's going to take 10 minutes. What do we do? People look at their phone, whatever. And Louis would come up, and he would, if he had a script in front of you, he would come up and just write a, draw a dick on it, and then the dick would shoot jizz onto you in the in the drawing. And then it'd be like, all right, lens has changed. And then you'd be like, ah, so you're laughing. Then you have to stop laughing while, you know, they say action.
Hot Breath. What up, Hot Breath-averse? Yes. We are back, Hot Breath-isode number 175. This is your host, comedian Joel Byers. Welcome to the Hot Breath Podcast, your weekly guide to comedy mastery. If this is your first time listening, welcome aboard. If this is your repeat of time listening, you know what time it is. Hot Breath. Oh, that old familiar sound. I don't know what the word repetitive means, but I appreciate all you loyal hot brethren and sistren that listened along. Every single Monday, we're dropping new episodes with comedy's top comics all about comedy mastery. So welcome, all of our new listeners. Welcome to what we call the Hot Breath-averse. If you're a comedian or just a comedy fan, we appreciate all of you that tune in to get all of this comedy knowledge. So today's guest is certainly full of comedy knowledge. He was actually last week's guest, but we decided to throw it back a little bit. He was first on our podcast way back in Hot Breath episode number 84. We decided to do a follow-up. Interviewed him last week, so I thought I'd go ahead and toss up to the top of the playlist his first interview he did with us, because I know you're very busy and you don't want to scroll all the way through to episode number 84, so I thought I'd do it for you, make it easy for you. This is a good episode to hear some good stories about Judd Apatow and Louis C.K. and Amy Schumer, but also just comedy writing and the grind that this comic has been on. Long story short, he holds the record for the most shows in a year performing in New York. This is a comedian who is putting in the work, and I hope he inspires you to do the same. All we ask in return here at the Hot Breath-averse is for you to share these episodes with other comics, with other comedy fans. If you're out in an open mic, let them know, hey, I just heard this podcast. It was amazing interviews with comics. You really learn a lot. If you're at comedy shows, if you're just at your cubicle, that's how we grow. That's how we continue to grow. So we'll get into the interview. I just want to thank you so much for your time. And I do have some exciting news in the outro. If you could hang out with me for just a minute, I want to share some exciting news for how you can start to connect with awesome comics like Mark Normand as well. So I just released his name a little. You're supposed to, as an intro format, you're supposed to, you know, as you intro someone at a comedy show, you want to say their name last, but we already spilled the beans, so let's get into it, as there's only one thing left to do, and that is inhale a hot breath with Mark Normand.
I called a guy a cum-guzzling Nazi the other day, and that one I felt good about.
Was this at a show?
Yeah, it was a heckler.
And everybody went along with you.
Mm-hmm.
People accepted that?
Well, I think there's a little bit of poetry in that, at least. Those are great shoes. What are those?
Thanks, man. These are Echo.
Echo? I don't know Echo.
Echo, it's like, they're kind of like old people's shoes.
Oh, all right.
It's just, they're just made for comfort. Yeah, that's what I
like
go
that.
More than anything, yeah.
I have bad feet, so I have New Balance, which I think are the most comfortable shoes, and then I put a New Balance insole inside that just for an extra oomph.
What, are you going to get sponsored by them?
I'm trying. Jeez, I would love that, although they were the, what is it, neo-Nazis just claim they were like the shoe of the neo-Nazi, which is kind of a bummer.
It's true. I know you had the Penguin sponsorship, though.
Yes.
So.
Wow, you're good.
Oh.
How'd you know about that?
It was with Colbert, right?
Yeah, jeez. Yeah. You're killing it.
What? How'd you get that?
Are we on?
We are on.
Oh, shit. I had no idea.
Podcaster to podcaster here. We're on, man.
I didn't know about the cum-guzzling Nazi. Did that make it in?
We can take it out.
That's fine. Might offend some Nazis and some cum-guzzlers, but hey. Colbert. I posted a whole post like, hey, I'm doing Colbert, and Penguin saw it, and they said, hey, if you wear our suit, we'll give it to you for free, and we'll give you some extra clothes. So I said, all right.
They hit you up about it.
They hit me up, and... I never bought a suit in my life, and it was like a crazy baby blue suit, which I would have not have chosen, but it kind of worked, so.
Yeah, it looked great, too, man.
Oh, thanks.
You did great. I don't know if it was connected to, like, opening for Amy Schumer, if you get all these endorsement deals now.
I wish. That. I'm doing theater arenas with her with 10,000 people each night, so I feel like, hey, come on, if you want to make some eyeballs on these clothing.
Yeah.
You know, this is the right guy, but I never got hit up.
Well, this is a dope time to be interviewing you. You've been touring around doing arenas and everything. And the first time we talked, I guess when you were here opening for Amy at Phillips Arena, and we talked about doing a phone interview, but I wanted to face-to-face with Mark Normer. Because I know you hate eye contact.
Big
so
time.
So I wanted to make sure you were as uncomfortable as possible.
I'm uncomfortable with eye contact. Also, with your use of the word dope. That came out of nowhere.
Coming from somebody who said, come guzzling Nazi. Mm-hmm. That's a compliment, I guess.
I just feel weird using anything that's hip because, I don't know, hip stuff makes me very uncomfortable because it feels, it's just such a time stamp on it. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like saying groovy. And then you look back and you go, boy, how weird is that? They said groovy. What a bunch of weirdos. They said far out. Come on. And it's like, if you like the phrase, why don't you still use far out?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's just like same with dope. I feel like in 10 years, everybody's going to go, can you believe he said dope? I don't know. I worry about that. That's why I don't wear cool clothes. Because I'm so worried about, you know, if you like it, do it forever. You know, some kid's like, hey, I love Snoop Dogg. And then you go, you meet him when he's 40, and you go, why don't you like Snoop Dogg? And he goes, I was a kid. Well, you can still make it a decent choice. Is this making any sense?
Absolutely.
All right.
I'm just letting you ramble.
Yeah.
I can see you struggling off, over there. No, you're doing great, buddy.
When I was a kid, I liked Green Day. I still like Green Day.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get why people, you know, if you like something, I don't feel like you should like something just because it's hip. To me, that's very sheepish.
Right.
You're just following the pack.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
But you're on the fast track. You started opening for Amy just like 2 years into your comedy career, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
It was
fast.
Like, you had a big...
Very lucky. Pure luck. I was doing a show. I was bombing at this club called Comics, which is no longer there with an X. And I was bombing. One joke worked, and she happened to walk in on that one joke.
Oh, wow.
And she came in the green room and said, hey, that was fun. I feel like we'd have a good rapport. And I kind of thought she might have been hitting on me. And she goes, you want to do Hofstra, which is a college? Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that. And I was like, yeah, I just said yes. And then we did that. And that was it.
And now you're doing arenas.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing. What is it? What have you learned from kind of seeing her grow into this machine? Like, she's an industry now.
She's a monster. I mean, I watched her do a Hartford Funny Bone with, you know, 28 people. Then I watched her do a theater with 1,000 people, and that was insane. And then I watched her do arena. I mean... I just learned that she just knew. She was driven. She was like, I know I'm good. When is the world going to catch on, I think? And they did. They caught on. And she never buckled, you know? Like, she got the roast. That was the roast for Charlie Sheen was like mm-hmm. That was a big break for her. And she was like, I'm ready. Bring it on. I would have been like, oh, my God, this roast. I'm freaking out. But she never had that.
Mm-hmm.
She was like, let's just do it. Let's come on. Let's get it over with, and then we'll do the next thing. Which I don't have. I have a Conan coming up, and I've done it 4 times. I'm already nervous about it.
How long until that?
A few months. I got a while.
So you prep, though. Like, what is the prep for when you do a Conan?
Oh, my God. Well, first you have to send him a tape, and then he approves what jokes he likes. Then you go over the order of the jokes, so it's a long process. And then you might write a new joke that you feel like is better than the one in there already. So mm-hmm. then you send him a tape of that, and he goes, Well, maybe that is better. So you swap it out. So that changed the whole order again. So now you got to redo the whole 5 minutes with that new one in there and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, then you just run it to hell and back. So it's second nature, you know.
But the first time you perform on Conan, you do a joke they told you not to do.
That's right. Well, I did crowd
about, like,
work.
Puerto Ricans, right?
Yeah, yeah. They said, don't do that joke. And I knew in my heart that the joke would kill. And I knew it would be a better set if I did it. And I did it. And it worked. And no one said a thing. No one said, you piece of shit. That's the thing about this business is in show business, everybody's scared. Everybody's nervous in the industry. Like the producers and the showrunners, they're all nervous that you're going to say something offensive, say something wrong. It's not going to work. But if it works, they don't mention it. They never go, oh, my God, you lied and you cheated us and you faked us out. They go, great job. But if you do it and it doesn't work, they hate you and you're a piece of shit and you get fired.
Well, they had you back every year.
They had me back every year, and I'm going back this year.
What, do you just hit them up now, and you're like, hey, how about I...
Yeah, I go, hey, it's been a year. What do you think? And they go, yeah, yeah, send us a tape.
That's awesome.
I mean, the tapes have to be up to par still.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
That's great. That was my goal for 2016 was to get on Conan.
Oh, yeah?
So that clearly worked out. Nah.
Well, you know, it's never this business never goes the way you think it will.
Yeah, I guess you were in Trainwreck, but then got cut out.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
I mean, you do have the burden and the obstacle of being a straight white man.
Yes, that is true, yes.
And
yes.
I know a lot of people don't want to hear that. You know, a lot of people at home going, oh, fuck you, come on. But it's true. Every meeting I go to now, it's like, hey, we like your idea, but we got too many white guys.
We had a good run, though.
We had a great run.
It's
great
like run. We can't really complain.
Well, here's the thing is the generation before us had a great run. Now we're getting screwed because of them, you know? And then the people go, whoa, what about slavery? And I'm like, well, you know, that was another group.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same group, but another time.
Yeah.
I don't know. The whole too many white guys is like a big movement now. And I get it. There's a lot of white guys. But it's not like we're sitting at JFK Airport going, hey, minority comedian, get the hell out of here. It's just a lot of white guys. It's not like we're purposely doing anything. We're not going, hey, whitey, we're not going to Arkansas and recruiting white people. There's just a lot of white people. What do you want? There's a lot of white people in the country.
It seems to be working out for you, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm not complaining. I mean, I guess I am. But, you know, you want it all, as every group does. You know, if you cast a Mexican guy in this role, they go, oh, you only put us in this role. And then if you don't cast the Mexican guy, they go, oh, you never put us in any roles. So you're like, oh, fuck, what do I do? But I'm doing fine, and I've had a few show ideas turned down that I think if I was Aziz, not that level, but if I was a Indian American or whatever he is, I think I might have sold it. But yeah, I don't know. Doing well, can't complain. All I want to do is tell jokes for a living, and I'm doing that, so I'm happy.
What kind of shows were you pitching? Are these like sitcoms or more like hosting shows?
Four sitcoms. I've pitched three game shows, three reality shows. I've pitched a couple web series. Yeah, I've been pitching for like 8 years now, and nothing is gone.
You're just always writing?
Always writing. Always got to have an idea. You know, something pops in your head and jot it down, send out a one sheet. Then somebody goes, hey, this is pretty good. Then you go pitch. You make a pitch packet. Then you go pitch it. And then they go, hey, we like it. You have a whole bunch of jokes in the pitch. And then 2 weeks later, they go, yeah, we're going to pass.
What are they looking for?
I mean, they're looking for diversity. They're looking for a lot of, they want young. They want everything to be young. Like, you know, the demographics that buy shit are young people, like 18 to 24 or whatever. So I don't know if I'm capturing that demo, but that's what they want.
Have you thought about film? I know you went to film school.
I thought about film, and I've done a few short films, but since I went to film school, I realized how almost impossible it is to get a film made.
A lot of moving parts.
Yeah, and I don't have that kind of time or patience or money. You got to have a lot of money and people backing you. And like Birbiglia, you got to hand it to him for making two independent movies that have been somewhat successful. I don't think he's made money off of it, but people saw him.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty good.
What did you learn from working with Judd Apatow?
Oh, my God. That guy's he's the real deal. Like, he's a big, fat, famous guy, just a big director guy. And he's a guy who's just like, this is how I want it. I want you to improvise. I want you to be yourself. I want you to be funny. And it's not all about, like, I memorized the lines to Hell and Back. And right when I got there, he's like, all right, what else you got? So I'm like, what do you mean, what else do I got? I memorized the lines. Wow. And he's like, yeah, but you riff. And I was like, oh, my God. So then somehow we got into a cut. And he goes, everybody go back to your, maybe it was lunch. I went back to my trailer. I wrote out, like, 20 alternative lines. Uh-huh. I just was in my trailer just scribbling away. And I got back, and I tried them all. He hated all of them. And he goes, what else you got? I go, ah, shit. And so it was tough, but he's a pro, and honor to work with him.
Yeah, it must have been a little intimidating.
Oh, very intimidating.
He's the guy.
Very intimidating. He's just so comfortable out there. He's in his chair on a swooping crane, you know, going over with a big jib. And he's just like eating corn nuts going, all right, action, what else you got? You suck, get out of the way. You know, it's quite a moment.
So you're not much improv as much as you're word for word. That's how you, like, your stand up, like, just to use that as the example, like, you don't really improvise much. Once you find it, you just stick to those notes.
I feel like the jokes, Todd Barry had a great quote. He said, keep the jokes tight and the set loose. And I think that's perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect for me. That's what I do. You were at the show last night.
Yeah.
You know, the joke, I want the joke to be 100% this way. I might change a word or two here or there, but I want that joke to, I want it to know how it begins, finishes, beginning, middle, and end. And, but then in the middle of it, you can fuck around. And I like that.
What's the writing process here? What is, cause you write a lot. So what do you,
It's not as good as it should be. I get an idea from start to finish. I get an idea that pops in my head. I jot down that idea. Then I take it over into I do an hour of writing every day, about maybe an hour and half an hour. I take it into that, and then I just play with it. I just walk around my room and just say it and say this and that, and this guy says it, that guy says it, how I, you know, it's like clay. You're kind of like molding it and squishing it, which sounds incredibly pretentious. But, you know, you're just fucking around with it, and then something funny happens, and then you write that down. And then something else funny happens, you write that down. So eventually you get like four or five funny lines. Then you try it on stage. Four out of the five lines don't work, but one does, and you keep that one. Then you try it again.
So you'll just talk through your jokes. You're not really pen to paper as much.
No, I'm only pen to paper when I feel like something clicks, and then I'll write that down just so I don't forget it. But it's all talky. It's all walkie and talky. Yeah.
I mean, I've tried to do that some, but then I just feel crazy. Did you have to overcome feeling crazy just talking to yourself for an hour?
Totally. I mean, there's a point where you feel like maybe somebody might hear you in another room. Then you get all embarrassed. Then there's a point where you feel like a weirdo just talking out loud. So you have to go, all right, I'm doing it. Here we go. Talking out loud. Yeah, let's get it over with. All right. And you have to actually do that. That's why I can't write in Starbucks. I would get kicked out. I would look like a lunatic. But these guys just write sitting down. With all these people around them, drinking coffee, walking around, I can't do it.
I mean, is the same, like, you've written a bunch of scripts and everything. Is that the same process for writing scripts?
No,
you have characters and talking?
Scripts is tough. That's because comedy can be so abstract and weird and all over the place. You can have a joke about dogs and go into a joke about anal, then go into a joke about shoes. Scripts have to have a inciting incident and an arc and a plot and narrative and dialogue, and then has to come together at the end. So that takes so much more discipline and so much more of like an outline and a formula, which I'm way bad. I'm so bad with that. Just the fact that I said way bad. And see, in stand-up I could say that, but in the script I'd have to take that out. So it's tough for me with a script, because that's like more of a, that's like an assignment. That's homework. Comedy is more just, let's figure out how to make this funny and then say it out loud, and then we're done.
And you're great at finding, like, comparisons and contrasts.
Thanks. I try. I'm a big analogy guy because I think in analogies. That's why I'm so bad at math. I'm horrible at math. But I'm a big analogy guy because I don't think anything conveys a point as well as an analogy. And I have a weird – so I'll throw a weird idea at you, and the audience goes, huh? But then I throw the analogy at you, and you go, all right, now I get it. So I think that's why I do it.
Like your Colbert set, you have a joke about how we can't cure hangovers, or we can't prevent hangovers, but we can prevent kids.
Yes.
And then you take it into how, like, you're not honest drunk, you're actually honest when you have a hangover.
Yes.
So, like, how did that kind of start and grow into that?
That was a weird one. Well, the kids thing, Like, I always used to say, isn't it weird we can't prevent a hangover? And everybody goes, yeah, yeah, whatever. And I'm like, no, hang on. This is where the analogy comes in. Mm-hmm. I go, but we can prevent children. We figure that out. And people go, oh, yeah, that's true. We can prevent children, but we can't prevent a hangover? Now I see why your point holds water. So I have to throw that in there just so people go, oh, I get where you're coming from now. And then the hangover thing is I'm hungover all the time, and I've always thought – people always say, like, oh, this guy's such a bad drunk, and he's got to quit drinking. And I'm like, I'm fine drunk. I can drink and drive. I can drink and have a conversation. I'm not, like, a blackout guy, really. But when I'm hungover, I'm a mess. And I was, like, I have a hangover problem, not a drinking problem, you know? So that I realized that, and then I was like, all right, well, maybe there's a bit here. And then that came into that.
So is it like...
When I'm hungover, I can't leave the house. My anxiety's through the roof. I can't. I got a couch delivered the other day when I was hungover, and I didn't answer the door. So these movers are at my home with a couch outside my door buzzing, and I just couldn't do it. I couldn't answer the door because I was too anxiety-riddled. I was too fucking nervous and weird. I couldn't do it. So I never got the couch.
So it was good to hear you got furniture.
No, no couch.
Still no couch. Mm-mm. Well, with the we can prevent kids but not hangovers, did it start off as we can't prevent hangovers, and then you just tried to riff on a bunch of different examples and the kids one stuck, or did it immediately fall in like that?
The kids one is good because it's such an extreme, you know, like, yeah. I need something that really, like, grabs you. Like, mm-hmm. if I say, oh, we can prevent termites, you're like, yeah, yeah, but you're like, we can prevent kids, and then you think abortion and, like, you think birth control. It's a heavier example, and I think that's why I went with it.
Will you find stuff on stage as well? Because, I mean, you had the most sets of any New York comedian, like, for a year, right?
Hey, I think it still stands.
It's still. Do you know the total?
I don't know the total because you start trying to keep track and then you lose it. And
right. Yeah.
It's a whole year, but I think I have the most. I got a real problem. I might be losing it now because I do the road so much, and you only do one or two shows every night.
Oh,
but in
bummer.
New York,
yeah,
in New York you can do six.
Yeah, what a bummer! I'm on the road getting paid.
I know, yeah, I'm not complaining. I love the road. I get most of my work done on the road.
Yeah,
because in an hour set you can try more new. Like last night, I tried like five new jokes and two worked. So,
what were those? The race ones?
No, one was racial. Some, yeah. One was about being born gay. One was about shit, what was that? Oh, one was about fat cops.
Oh yeah.
There's something there. That
there is something there.
But yeah.
But I love how it didn't work, but you're like, there's just something there. Say it out loud.
And I kept talking about it, and then one line hit and I got it on my phone, so I'm gonna listen to that today and then see what that one line is and then go back and try to sculpt the rest of the joke around that one line that works.
Are you disciplined in listening back on all your sets?
I'm pretty good, but I'm not as good as I should be. I'll listen 100% for sure. I'll listen if I know there's some perfect line in there that I need to keep. Mm. But if it's just a regular set where everything worked or whatever, then you go, I already know that. Like if you do a bunch of old jokes and they all work, I have no point in listening to it. There's no point because I already know that shit.
Mm-hmm.
You're only listening to get some information.
Are you do have a lot of drinks about... Not drinks. You have a lot about, sorry, it's St. Paddy's Day.
That's right. Hey, go go Irish or whatever.
But you do have a lot of jokes about, you know, like women and dating and drinking. But I did notice last night, you seem like you're trying to push more of like having more of a message.
Oh, shit. Really? I don't want to be that guy.
Well, not like preachy. I mean, I know you like George Carlin was one of your favorites.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
But he could be preachy at times and almost like pointing instead of just like being more... just eloquent about it, but I'm making judgments on one of the best comedians to ever live. But
sure.
Anyway,
I think the best. Some people, everybody gives it to Pryor, and I think Pryor is a funnier guy, and I think Pryor had probably the best comedy special ever. But if pound for pound, Carlin had 14, Pryor had what, 5?
Yeah,
and then he hit every genre. He would do wordplay. He would do topical. He would do society stuff, social commentary, puns. So I feel like he covered more of a bigger umbrella of comedy.
Yeah.
But I think Pryor's a funnier guy. Like if there's a YouTube clip of Pryor and Carlin on Carson together. Carlin says three things. Pryor's killing the whole time just off the cuff.
Yeah.
So I think he's quicker, funnier, but I think Carlin's a better stand-up comic.
Yeah, he was definitely more methodical and precise about his career. He had his own office. Did you know that?
Yeah, yeah.
He had an office he would report to for writing.
See, that's unbelievable. And then he had this database. He had like an old school computer, and he would have like God jokes, sex jokes, family, and he just had it. So he could go back to his database and go, what was that one bit I had on donkeys? And go to his animal file, you know. Crazy.
How do you organize your material?
Oh, boy. Well... not as well as I should. Here, I'll show you this. This is my jeans. My jeans are on the floor here. I'm pulling out a stack of papers.
Oh, geez.
And a little notebook. Yeah, this is it. That's my file cabinet. I got to digitize this shit because it's...
wow.
I've forgotten jokes. I've lost jokes in the washing machine. That's just a stack of papers with notes scribbled on them.
You just carry around everywhere you go?
Everywhere I go. Some of those pages are months old.
And you haven't looked at them since you wrote on them?
No, but I'm like, oh, there's something on here that I should remember, and I never, you know.
What I was getting at with the racial stuff, or you having more of a message or whatever, is that you were trying to address, like, race seemed to be something you were trying to hammer home, and it was in the middle of your set, so I didn't know if that's when you were trying to work out some maybe different points of view.
Yeah, I'm trying. The racial stuff is actually working, but I feel like my act, if you really... break it down. Oh boy, this is some heavy nerd comedy shit here, but if you really break my act down, all my premises, mostly 90% of them, are about things that people won't really tell you, you know, like things that it's not really appropriate to talk about, you know. I don't know about appropriate, what's the word I'm looking for? It's things where if you went up to your aunt and you were like, hey aunt, what's up with Jews? She'd be like, okay, what? And she'd get all weird and then walk away. So then I go, well, I gotta learn about Jews now, because she won't tell. I find that interesting when we all know these truths, but you can't really talk about it in certain settings. And I think that's the stuff that interests me the most. And I feel like race is the number one of those things. Obviously, sex, you know, is a big one. You can't really like shit that you talk about at work that would get you fired. That's the stuff that interests me, because not because I'm like, ooh, edgy, but because I want to know and no one will tell me. Yeah. And I think race is the number one. Now if you go up to your boss at work and go, Asian people can't drive is a stereotype. Is that true? And he'll be like, shit, what? And you're like, well, is it true or not? And he's like, get the hell out of here. What are you doing? You're making me feel weird. Those questions plague me, because I'm like, is it true? Is it not true? And you get all... I just start wondering about it. So I'm like, well, let's actually figure out if it's true. You know, you go up to a girl, maybe in like fifth grade, and you go, do you masturbate? And they go, what? Oh, my God, how could you ask me that? And you're like, well, I just want to know, do you? And they go, oh, my God, and they never tell you. And that's the whole point of my whole show, I think. Like, I have a joke in my act where I say, I was talking to this guy, and I go, what's the name of the new guy, the black guy? And he goes, I don't see color. And I'm like, well, then I'm black. And he goes, no, you're not. And I'm like, well, ha-ha. You're lied to me. So it's like those things where, like, everybody's kind of full of shit, but you know there's something there that they won't tell you. That's my whole act. That's what I want to dig deep into. And that's why I talk about race so much, because it's the number one thing people won't tell you. If that makes sense. Sorry, that was a long answer, but I think we got
it. It was a great answer.
Oh, come on.
Oh, it was a great answer, Mark. You're doing great, buddy.
I appreciate it.
Race is definitely, you know, I'll do a lot of urban rooms as well. I'll do like mainstream and urban rooms. And I know you grew up as like the only white guy where you were in New Orleans.
Yeah, my hood.
So do you have, what's your experience with urban rooms?
Man, I used to do a lot of them. I like them because there's an honesty to it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's like, there's more black folk, if we will say that, instead of urban. I feel like they have like a better bullshit meter. Mm-hmm. White people are bullshitting all day. You know, we like it. It's easier to deal with, to just take the bullshit and run with it, than it is to face the facts. And so I like the urban rooms because there's no bullshit. If I say a buzzword in a white room, they're just going to hear that buzzword a lot of the time. But if I say a buzzword in a black room, they're going to go, okay, what's his point? And I like that. I think that's important. Like, I used to have a joke about black people are great because they're way more honest than white people. Like, I bought these new shoes And I was like, are these shoes corny? Are these shoes dumb? And all my white friends were like, oh, they're fine. They're great. I like the shoes. And then I bumped into a black teenager on the subway, and he goes, watch what you're going with those corny-ass shoes. And I go, I knew it. I knew it. No one would tell me except for this one black teenager. So I appreciate that, and that's why Urban Rooms are great. But on the flip side, they're almost too honest, because if you bomb, they'll literally boo you.
Has that happened to you?
Oh, my God. I've been booed twice.
Oh, let's hear it.
Well, one, there's this room in Harlem called the Mocha Lounge, and me and my friend Mike Lawrence used to go up there for kicks, which I guess sounds kind of racist. We're like, let's go up to this black room because it'll be an adventure. And it was in Harlem. It was like all black audience. The host was like the blackest man alive, just this guy named Smokey.
Smokey and, Suarez?
Yes. Oh, you know, cool. Smokey?
Yeah.
Holy shit. That's crazy. So we go up once, and I had the set of my life. I wouldn't say the set of my life, but I had a good set, and I was very just in the moment, and like I could tell the audience was into it. And then I had another set where I got cocky, and I bombed, and they booed me, and they cut the mic, and it was a whole thing. And then after I got off stage, the host tore me to pieces. You know.
That was one. You said you've been booed twice?
There was another time. It wasn't that cool, but I went to...
It wasn't that cool.
It wasn't as fun as that story, but I went to this place also in Harlem. And this guy went on stage and did a bunch of sound effects.
Mm.
And I went up after him, and I was like, hey, I didn't know Michael Winslow was still working. And he was booing me just by himself.
Uh-huh.
So I was getting laughs, but he was like, boo, fuck this guy, boo, because I had made fun of him.
Right.
And that was it. Then he came up to me after, and he said, if you make fun of me again, I'll kill you. And I said, all right, let's get out of here.
And then you stopped doing the Urban Rooms?
Well, I stopped doing the Urban Rooms because I started getting regular work.
Yeah,
you know,
mm-hmm.
But I got doing a show in Harlem, I think, next week. So I'm never like a room's a room. I'll never be like, that's an urban room, I won't go. I haven't been getting booked there as much.
When you were in New Orleans, what was the scene like? Because like here in Atlanta, there the scene is somewhat segregated.
Oh, and really?
There's some rooms that are integrated, but most of it's like there's white rooms and then there's like black rooms.
You're right.
So I mean, is New York similar?
Well, there's definitely both, but I think it's pretty open to everyone. Like,
mm-hmm.
You know, if I go up to an urban room, I'll see a white comic there on the lineup as well, you know? So I don't think it's too, pardon the pun, black and white, but I think there's always going to be a little bit of some sort of segregation. Nah, that's a bad word, but you know, there's always going to be a little bit of like, well, this is the black room, this is the white room, But I think we do a lot. We try to, especially now, there's a lot more intermixing because, you know, people want a diverse lineup.
Mm-hmm.
But a New Orleans scene, oh, man, I remember I did the show once. It was totally urban to the max. And I went on stage, and I looked on the side of the stage, and there was a gap between the stage and the wall, and it was full of stool, like broken stools. Because all these stools have been humped so many times. It was like a stool graveyard on the floor and between the stage and the wall, which I thought was great. Because they didn't clean it up. They just pushed it all to the side when a stool would break. But New Orleans scene was pretty, I guess, pretty segregated as well. But the urban scene was, they were both super small. So you didn't really notice because there was really no scene anyway. So this, mm-hmm. Both scenes were so small you didn't really think about it. But now New Orleans is kind of coming up a little bit, but it's still not like I'm going to make it here.
Right,
know?
Right, right. Yeah. What is your take on Atlanta's scene? Have you been able to hang out much here at all?
Atlanta's not bad. You know, you got two clubs, right? Or the Improv closed?
The Improv closed. It's supposed to reopen.
Okay.
And then we had...
The Punchline, is that done?
Punchline's open, yeah.
Oh, great.
Punchline, they just moved.
Okay.
They had moved. Punchline, we have Laughing Skull where you're at.
Yeah.
And Uptown...
Oh, that's right.
Atlanta Comedy Theater.
Oh, that's a lot.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, Atlanta scene's pretty good. I've done a show here. Where was it? It's in some, might have been an open mic, but it's in some bar with the back has a stage.
Was it a 1 a.m. show?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. 1 a.m. show, Smissel Bar.
Yes, that was pretty good. And then you got the Relapse.
Yeah.
You got a lot of shit here.
Yeah. That's why we think, I mean, that's why I'm still here, because I would like to just blow up from here instead of moving and starting over.
Right.
It's kind of my mindset.
True, but I will say, if you go to New York, or you think of New York or L.A., because you're a handsome cat. You could probably make some waves in L.A., like TV-wise.
But my whole focus is being good at stand-up.
Okay, all right, well then I'd go to New York.
But that's why I'm still here, is because I can get on, you know, here you can get on 2 or 3 times a night. So I can get a lot of stage time here and just get good and then hope I'll gravitate some sort of opportunity.
Right, right.
That's my naive take on comedy.
Yeah, yeah. No, I get it. But I will say, even if you go to New York with like a hot 10 minutes, you will have to start over in some fashion because you're new to everybody. So even if you're killing, no one knows you. So you got to kill for a while so they get to know you.
Right, yeah.
So you're not starting over material-wise. You're starting over getting to know people-wise.
Yeah. Because you went to New York once and moved back, right? New Orleans?
I went to New York for a film school.
Okay.
So then I was doing stand-up at night, like at open mics and bombing. And then I went back to New Orleans and was wildly depressed. And I didn't know why. It was because I wasn't doing mics anymore. So then I started doing open mics in New Orleans, which is like once a week, twice a week, maybe. And I was like, this isn't enough stage time. So I moved to New York.
Did you move back in with your parents?
Yeah, That didn't help.
Back into the only white family in the neighborhood?
Yeah, well, they had moved by then because 2 guys broke in with guns and held my parents up. Oh. And so they moved to a better neighborhood.
You've been robbed a lot.
Oh, my God. Countless times. We got robbed probably once every 2-3 months. Rough, rough neighborhood. We were sitting ducks. We lived in a mansion in a poor black neighborhood, and we were the one white family, so people just assumed we were killing it. But little do they know, that house was dilapidated. So I think a lot of guys would break in and be like, oh, shit, this is it?
This is like a squat. Look how you're squatting in there.
Kind of, yeah. There was one wing. My dad ran out of money fixing up the house, so he made half of it into a bed and breakfast. Mm. So that half was immaculate. And then the half we lived in was a fucking shit show.
What did they do for a living?
Both lawyers at the time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, one time I walked in on a robbery. I told my parents about it, so they moved their practice into the house because they were like, we can't leave these kids alone in this neighborhood. That's how bad it was.
How many siblings do you have?
Older brother.
Older brother?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. It's good they actually, they cared. I didn't know if they did. They always let you earn it on your own, you know?
Yeah, I guess they did give a shit a little bit. I mean, not enough to move us out, but they cared a little. I mean, by the time I moved, I was in college like 2 years later. But yeah, it was a rough upbringing. Like I would hear, you'd hear like glass breaking at night in your house, you know, shit like that. Crazy.
You just ignore it?
You just had to put out of your mind. We had an alarm. The cops knew us, too. They'd come over all the time. They were like, oh, the Normans are getting robbed again.
Yeah.
We had a crazy alarm system that was like, wow, 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 wow. And you just hear that all the time. I know that sounds so well. And you'd hear it like 1 a.m. and you just like pray to God no one comes in and kills you with a gun, you know?
What is their take? You dropping out of LSU and then going to film school and then, oh, I got to move back home. Like, how do they react to these lawyer parents?
I think my parents were pretty cool. They were like ex-hippies.
Oh, okay.
So they kind of got it. And plus, I literally had zero going on in my life. I like failed out of 2 colleges. I got back into one eventually. And I was such a drunk piece of shit. And I had zero prospects. I remember telling my dad, I go, we'd go to a restaurant, and I'd be like, yeah, but it'd be pretty good working here. And he's like, what are you doing? He, like, snapped on me. He's like, what are you doing? Get a real job. Come on. You have something. Work on it. And so I just tried. I was such a loser that anything I wanted to try, they were like, go for it. Try anything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, how about film school? They're like, great. We'll pay for it. Go for it. And I was like, all right. How about stand-up? They're like, great. Go for it. So I think it was just like a desperation thing.
Yeah.
Like, please, make some moves.
You're like, oh, I'm going to go be a janitor. Let's do that.
Yeah, yeah. But that, they would have been like, well, they wanted something with a future.
Mm-hmm.
And which is how, that shows how bad I was off when they're like, stand up, try it, please. That might work.
So were you a big troublemaker?
Oh, yeah, big troublemaker. Arrested 3 times for peeing in public, which is weird. Just a booze bag. I wrecked my dad's Lexus. Got a DUI. You know, shit like that. It was bad times. I used to live in a house with 5 guys in college, and our whole mission in life was like, we found this liquor store that if you brought in 3 empty keg shells, they would give you a full keg. And we were like, well, this is our whole life now. So we would just drive around Baton Rouge where I was going to college, and we would just go jump into people's backyards, take their keg, go to the back of a bar where they had keg stacks, steal those. We got into fist fights, we got chased, we got the cops called on us, but we'd get those kegs. And then it was like a full day's work. We'd go turn in like 9 keg shells and get 3 full kegs and just keep them in the house.
So you've been stealing your whole life.
A lot of stealing, yeah. I was a big street sign stealer.
Mm.
And our whole house was just full of like one-way, stop, yield, you know, slippery when wet. And one time we had a party and the cops came and like broke it up. And they saw the signs. They were like, oh, you guys are all going to jail. This is like, this is like hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of merchandise or whatever, city merchandise. And I remember they had like extra guy. They called for backup for all the people to take them off the walls because they had so many. Yeah. It was wild times.
Seems like you're getting your life together now.
Yeah, things are good now. I just needed some direction. That's all, uh-huh. Which is such a cliche term, but I just needed something to go towards because I had a lot of energy, but I didn't have anything to put it into. So we would just steal and drink.
So what is it going towards now?
Now it's towards writing more comedy, trying to do good jokes and be a good comedian and put out specials and albums and maybe get on TV and shit like that.
Well, you've opened up for Amy. You've opened up for Louis as well. I mean, what was that experience like?
Louis was Amy is amazing. She changed my life. You know, she's given me so much. I have an apartment now in New York because of her. She's so generous. She gets a bad rap. Everybody shits on her all day long. And I have to, like, defend her to people, which is so crazy to me because she's such a good person and so giving. And people say she steals jokes, which is insane. I mean, she doesn't really watch a lot of comedy. She's so busy. She's not, like, sitting down going, let me watch this, Dave Chappelle special from 2001. She's working. You know, she's writing a show or being in a movie or writing a new hour. So the whole thing's crazy, but, people – that's what we do in this country. We like to just build somebody up and then rip them down.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Ronda Rousey. You know, she's on the way up. Everybody's like, look how great this female boxer or MMA chick is killing it. Oh, my God. She had, like, inspirational quotes. Everybody's quoting.
Yeah.
And then she gets knocked out. Everybody's like, fuck her. She deserved it. She sucks. It's the same with Amy.
How is she reacting to it? Like, how does she handle it?
She's tough as nails. I don't know how she does it. I get one negative tweet, and I get in the fetal position and cry. But she's I think she just at some point realized, okay, this is gonna happen, and I either got to keep going and fight it or just crumble, and she's keeping going.
Does that make you a little apprehensive? Like, would you one day want to hit her level? Is that a goal?
No, I don't think I ever want to be that. She's like superstar, you know. I don't think I ever want to be that. Mm-hmm. I'd want to be like a Segura. You know, something like that, just where you have your fans, you sell out a nice show or two, and then you go home, and like Segura can still walk through an airport, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Who's another guy that you'd want? Like Bill Burr is almost too big at this point, you know. I guess you want the good life, you want the money, but I don't know. I think because once you have that fame, you can't really lose it. You know, like John Mulaney's a guy, like that's a good level.
Okay, yeah.
You know, so yeah. What was the question? Oh, Louis. Louis was amazing. Louis fucking Jesus. He's the guy I watched before I even did comedy. So to work with him, it's like that Seinfeld thing. He's like, I can't believe life is so long that I'm working with people I grew up watching, you know? And just probably the best comic working today. He's like our Carlin, and just edgy and poignant, interesting and original. So original. He's a guy who worries about if this joke has been done to a T, and he's like, I've heard jokes like that, so I won't go that way. He's the king, and just a humble guy. Like, if you compliment him, he gets all embarrassed, and he just cares about good comedy, and just sweet guy and very giving, and those shows were amazing, and watching him was amazing. So, yeah.
So you guys sat down and like discussed jokes? Like,
oh yeah, we would bounce bits because jokes are his whole life. That's his whole thing.
Uh-huh.
So he'd be like, what are you working on? What do you got? And it's fucking terrifying. You go, oh, I got this idea, and he's like, oh, that's good. But I remember he had a great note. I had one joke. I would talk about how getting dizzy is a kid's version of getting drunk. Like getting dizzy is that's what kids, you know, wind. What do you call it? Take the edge off. You know, like, oh, I had a rough day, I'm going to hit that merry-go-round, blah, blah, blah. Silly joke, very, you know, cutesy. But he was like, you got to make it personal. So now he's like, every joke is funnier if it's personal. So I never forgot that. I'm like, all right, I got to remember that. Every time I'm writing, I go, make it personal, make it personal. So instead of saying hangovers are weird, I go, I was hungover today. You know, just make it, it gives it that extra little kick, you know?
Yeah.
So that was great. His special, this new special is coming out. I don't know when this pod comes out, but his new hour is unreal.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Like, he really kicked it up a notch.
You opened up for his Netflix special,
yes,
right?
Yeah, which was a fucking honor. Crazy story. I was sitting in the back of the Comedy Cellar. Louis sitting there, and we've hung out. I did Horace and Pete.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
So I've worked with him a few times, so I feel like I can talk to him. Oh, did you hear that? Jesus. So we're sitting in the back of the Comedy Cellar, and he goes, "Do you go on yet?" I go, "I already went on." He goes, "All right, so am I next?" I was like, "I don't know." And we're making fun of the comic on stage. He was a bit of a hack. And we're making fun of him. And Louis goes, "Oh, shit, you got $20? And I go, "Huh?" He goes, "You got $20? And I go, "Yeah." And I look at my wallet. I have $120 in there. That's it. And like a moth flew out. And he goes, "You got $20? I go, "Yeah." And I gave him my $120. And he runs out. He had to tip a driver or something. And he comes back in. He goes, "I'll pay you back. Don't worry." And I kind of remember thinking like, shit, that was like my money for the night, you know? And he's like, "I'll pay you back. Don't worry." And then he does his set, gets off stage. And they hand him some money. Because he did a show or something happened where he goes, "You know what? I don't have any money, but you want to do Town Hall tomorrow," which is like this beautiful theater in Midtown, New York. And I was like, "Yeah, of course." And he's like, "All right, I'll pay you back then." So I do Town Hall, and that was amazing. Finally opening for Louis. Oh, my God, wow. Town Hall. I had a great set. He watched. He gave me some notes on my set. And then he goes, "I'm doing some other dates if you want to come out." I said, "Yeah." And that was how I got the special. All for $20. Best. I never got the 20 back, but it was the best investment I've ever made.
Paying his way to the top.
Yeah, exactly.
Mark Norman.
What if I had a five? That guy had that 120 in there. You know, it's crazy opportunity.
That's so cool. You're sitting in the back of the room making fun of the comic on stage, like you're at just some open mic with another.
That's the thing about
Louis.
He's one of us. He's just like a comic. Like us, but he's just older and wiser and better than us at comedy. But he's just the same guy. Like, it's like if me and you were hanging out at Chipotle, Louis's like that. He can just sit there. He gets food on his shirt. He's, you know, he makes a joke that bombs on the table. Like, he's just that guy. He's just like a normal comedian.
Are there any other notes or wisdom that you think my listeners would like to hear from him?
From him? Shit. Not much. He told a lot of great stories, but I can't think of any now. Oh, boy, I'm on the spot here.
That's fine.
I'll think of it as we go.
Yeah, we can come back to it. Because okay. I also wanted to ask, because you've worked with Judd.
Yes.
And how was it like working with Louis in that realm?
Well, Judd was different because it was a movie set.
It was a big feature film.
So it wasn't like
Hollywood.
I was getting a lot of one-on-one, you know, with Judd. There's like 80 people around, there's lighting guys and grips and all this. So. Yeah. Joe's just like, action, try this, try that, you know. Judd was tougher, but Louis, I'm sitting in a car with him for an hour. I'm sitting on a plane with him for an hour, you know. We go out to dinner, so that was a whole different thing.
Mm-hmm.
But which is better for me anyway, because I'm more in a stand-up than I am in movies. But, yeah, Louis, I would take 2 days with Louis over 10 minutes with Apatow. Wait. That doesn't make sense.
But I mean, like, you were on Horace and Pete.
Yeah.
So him as a director, writer.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, that was still cool, though, Mark. Nah. It was very interesting.
You're very nice. Yeah, Horace and Pete, Louis is way different. Like, Louis, as a director, it's so loose. Like, we'll have a whole script, and you memorize everything. And then he gets there, and he goes, "Forget the script. Completely." Like, Apatow's like, "I want you to riff," but there's still like a structure of some kind. Louis's like, if the whole thing changes, he's fine with it. I'm talking different characters adding in, and then one guy dies in the middle of it. Like, if it's funny, he'll keep it in. So also, Louis did a weird thing, and I don't know if I should be divulging all this, but we would be sitting there, and like, they're like, "All right, we got to change the lens." So now we're all sitting at this bar, just kind of like, okay, well, they're changing a lens. It's going to take 10 minutes. What do we do? People look at their phone, whatever. And Louis would come up, and he would, if he had a script in front of you, he would come up and just draw a dick on it. And then the dick would shoot jizz onto you in the in the drawing. And then it'd be like, "All right, lens is changed." And then you'd be like, so you're laughing. Then you have to stop laughing while, you know, they say action. So there was like little things like that about Louis. Like, he's just a regular douchey, idiot, dumb guy, you know?
Yeah.
He's way more like he was in the scene too, you know, a lot of times. So it was different. Apatow is so behind the scenes. But yeah, Horace and Pete was unreal. I'm talking Apatow. I mean, Alan Alda calls you a cocksucker, and I'm sitting next to Kurt Metzger, who's going off about rape.
Yeah.
And Stephen Wright is to my right. You know, that was crazy. He has a line, and he would say a line differently, and Louis's like, "That's way funnier. Keep that." And Stephen Wright is such a genius in joke writing, and Louis knows that, so he'd be like, "How can we make this joke better?" And Stephen Wright would go, "Maybe we should try it like this." And he'd go, "Perfect, do that." So that was fun to watch. And then Buscemi's cool as shit.
Jeez, it seemed very collaborative.
Very collaborative, yeah. Almost too collaborative. Where you're like, "I think it might have been better in the script, but fuck it, he's on a roll." Yeah.
Well, I appreciate those behind the scenes.
Yeah, yeah, good times.
Yeah, man.
You just want that Louis time. He's like a. You know when there's like a puppy in the room? You just were like, "All right, let me hold the puppy now." Yep. That's how Louis... Excuse me. Hold on, I gotta get some water.
Yeah, you're good. You guys just...
Shit. Goddamn.
We almost made it. You got you choked up talking about Louis.
Got a crazy tickle. Whew, all right. Yeah, what was I saying?
You're talking about the puppy time with Louis?
Oh, yeah. When there's a puppy in the room, you're like, "Give me that fucking puppy. I want to just hold it the whole time." The same with Louis. When Louis's in the room, you're like, "I don't want to bug him, but you want him to just keep telling you shit. Like, I'll listen. Say it, lay it all on me. I'll take it." But you can't let him know that, you know? You can't be like, "Please tell me more, sir."
Well, since you're dying, we'll let you get out and relax before your shows this week. This weekend at the Lavish Skull. But before we adjourn,
yes,
is there anything else you want the world to know?
Be nice to everybody. The crazy times we're living in, but we'll get through it, and we're gonna look back at this and go, "Wow, that was nuts! What a country!" Try to be somewhat fair. Try to put yourself in other people's shoes, because right now everybody's me, me, me. My group. My city, my gender, my race, whatever. Look at other groups. Take a load off. Jesus Christ. And check out my special, May 12th. It's offensive. It's gay. It's fun. Comedy Central. So give it a whirl. Comes out on a Friday, May 12th, and it should be fun.
It's great. You're like, let's come together. Me, don't be me, 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 but my special.
Exactly. Yes. That's the world we're living in.
But it's well deserved. It's great to get a behind the scenes look and just to all the work that's going into the achievements you've had. So,
a lot of work. I'm going to be writing my ass off today.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time, Mark Normand.
Thank you. And I love everyone.
Woo. All right.
All right, hot brethren and sisterin. Work, work, work. It's so encouraging to hear someone at Mark Normand's level where we can just get lost in, "Oh, that he's gifted, he's talented, that's why he's there." But we learned in this episode that it all comes down to the work. So put in the work and you'll get the results sooner or later. Put in the work and just be consistent. And I have to say thank you to yous that listen, yous, but also thank you to Ruhal Dooley. My man sent $20. Hot brethren and sistren, if you have not been to our website, hotbreathpodcast.com, there is now an opportunity for you to contribute to the podcast and get things in return. A shout out on the podcast, a hot breath shirt, even a hot breath water bottle. There's a lot of having a podcast done in your hometown. I decided here, as we're building this comedy community, I want Hot Breath to become kind of like the town square of comedy and for us to come together and connect and learn from each other. So if you go to hotbreathpodcast.com, you can check out our blog, our merch shop, even just ways you can contribute through the appreciation donation section. Would actually $20, you get a shout out on here. So shout out to Ruhal Dooley. Thank you so much for the support. He sent me a message saying he's been listening for almost 4 years and he feels bad he hasn't contributed. So he's like, you deserve more, but here's $20 to start. So every little bit helps. If you have ever tried to run a podcast, you understand that it can take up to 15 hours to release a single episode from start to finish. So it is a lot of work. Hot Breath is still a labor of love, so anything you can contribute is greatly appreciated. And realistically, if you want to sponsor, I do am accepting sponsors as well. So if you want to get in front of an audience like we have here at Hot Breath and you want to promote your show or your festival or a service you provide, definitely message me, joelbyerscomedy@gmail.com, or DM me, joelbyerscomedy on all social media or at Hot Breath Pod. And if you want to start your own podcast, as I referenced, that it is a lot of work, but it's worth it. And the connections I've been able to make doing this, like meeting up with Mark Norman, how else would you ever just be able to sit down with someone like him for an hour and just dissect his process? This podcast has changed my life and my network, and I want to help you create your own podcast to do the same. So what I've done, I get asked podcast questions almost every day, so I decided to help out and create an online podcasting course. So in the show notes, you will see a link and a promo code. Because you're a Hot Breath listener, you get a special discount, but don't tell anyone. So go into the show notes, check out the link to the online podcasting course. This is going to tell you everything about how to start a podcast, what equipment to use, the artwork, the branding of it, how you can stand out from other podcasts, all of it. Everything I've learned in almost 4 years of podcasting, I put into this podcasting course to really help you get yours going faster. Because you can Google how to start a podcast and get over 600 million results, or just click the show notes, start your own, and support the culture, as we say here. And I'm also able to help out anybody with writing as well. I've done several Skype sessions with people. I've done set reviews. People have sent me their 5-minute sets, and I've given them constructive feedback on structure and writing and whatnot. So anything you have, I'm happy to help. So please don't hesitate. Those of you who have reached out know that I am accessible, and I encourage it. I want to connect with you. I want to help everyone connect with each other. So if you want to meet other Hot Brethren and Sister and other like-minded comics, we did start our own secret Facebook group called the Hot Breath Comedy Network. You can just search it on Facebook, ask to join, and you can start connecting with other listeners. We have people listening legitimately, like around the world. So it is so cool to help us all congregate into one place. So the network builds every single week, and I am so excited, and I'm so excited for you if this is your first or second time listening, I'm so excited for you to dive headfirst into what we call the Hot Breathiverse. So all that being said, keep grinding out there, kids. Comedy ain't easy, but it is worth it, and we're all here just trying to learn and get better, which is what Hot Breath is all about. So please connect with me. If you want to book me or anything, email me. My website, joelbyerscomedy.com. Of course, I said the podcast website, hotbreathpodcast.com. I even just posted a recent blog about the equipment I use for this podcast. So to a little more insight that way, go to the website, check it out. And just keep grinding out there, kids. I, of course, end all of these outros by thanking my wife. She made the theme song for this podcast. And of course, thanking you, my Hot Brethren and Sister, for your loyal listenership. And until next Monday, right here on Hot Breath. Hot Breath. This episode of Hot Breath is sponsored by our Patreon. If any of our content has helped your comedy career, join our Patreon linked in the show notes and get positive comedy karma for life. Probably.